on 2FM. With Green Farm, B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6.
On 2FM.
Yes, big thanks as always to the two Johnnies for taking us through this afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 1st of June, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Paul Corry and Roddy Forsyth chat soccer with the eyes of the world on Glasgow tonight as Scotland host Ukraine in a World Cup qualifier playoff.
And again now for Armstrong, and he put it through to Adams. Shay Adams is onto it. It's Adams!
Sticking with soccer, we'll also continue our build-up to Ireland's Nations League games. And in tennis, Colin Ireland will be with us once again, as well as former Irish Davis Cup captain Gary Call, to reflect on late-night drama at Roland Garros between Novak Djokovic and Rafa Nadal.
C'est le match Nadal. 3-6. 6-2, 4-6. 6-2, 7-6.
Yes, what a win for Rafa, and I'm delighted to say Nadine Doherty will also be live in studio with the latest LGFA news and AFLW news, with two stars of Gaelic football moving down under. And Ruby will have all the inside info ahead of the Oaks and the Derby this weekend at Epsom. And hopefully, Ruby, you might have a few tips for me as well.
Yeah, John Kenny stung me to the spot last night, and I didn't come up with too much shame, but look, you'll never know. So let's get through the next hour. And as always, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Our beautiful bed of music wasn't playing there, Ruby. It was just our dulcet tones for the next hour, and Paul Corry live in studio as well. Before we get through what we introed there, a couple of news headlines, Ruby, to throw your way. Paul
Pogba. Good news, Shane. It's all good news from what I read earlier.
Objective journalism as always, Ruby. I love it. So, the good news for Manchester United fans, if you're that way inclined, Paul Pogba will leave the club at the end of his contract. The academy graduate left Old Trafford as a free agent in 2012 to join Juventus in return for a then world record fee of €105 million. 4 years later, the club also confirmed fellow academy graduate Jesse Lingard will join Pogba in leaving the club at the end of his contract this summer. We will get the thoughts of Paul Corry, and Ruby Walsh will expand further on his feelings on Pogba and Lingard in due course. Sticking with soccer, Republic of Ireland international Ciara Grant has confirmed she will depart Rangers on the 1st of July. The former Shelburne midfielder will remain in Scotland, signing with Hearts, where she will become their second full-time player. In rugby, Munster have confirmed the appointment of the province's former back row Dennis Leamy as their new defence coach. Leamy will become part of Graham Rowntree's backroom team next season. The Tipperary native had been working as contact skills coach at Leinster this season, and shortly after the news of Leamy's departure broke this afternoon, Leinster confirmed the signing of the recently retired Sean O'Brien, who will return to his former province and fill the vacancy of contact skills coach. Finally, in golf, former world number one Dustin Johnson will head the field for the inaugural $25 million LIV Golf Invitational Series event in England, the new Saudi-backed golf circuit confirmed today. Former British Open champion and world number 20 Louis Oosthuizen, former Masters champions Charles Schwartzel and Sergio Garcia, plus former US Open champions Graham McDell and Martin Keimer are also in the field. So money talks in golf and money talks in football as well. Ruby, we've heard your thoughts on Paul Pogba and Jesse Lingard departing Manchester United. Paul Corry, do you share Ruby's sentiments?
Yeah, it seems, Shane, as if at the end of the last number of seasons we've had conversations about Man U kind of clearing out deadwood, and that kind of lends itself to poor recruitment first and foremost, and Paul Pogba certainly fits that tag. You know, £90 million that was spent on bringing him back to the club, it's very hard to pinpoint where the return on that investment has been, and he hasn't got, you know, he hasn't produced performances. Any of the managers that seem to have been there, whether it be Mourinho, Solskjaer or Ragnik of late, haven't been able to get a performance out of him, and he just kind of seems as if he's a bit of a toxic influence around the dressing room. He seems to maybe pull things down when the ship is sinking. And listen, you rewind 12 months ago, there's absolutely no doubt that they should have cut their losses and sold Pogba last year. They should have sold Lingard last year. When he came back from West Ham, they probably could have got a decent figure for him. And it all lends itself to poorly run club at this moment in time. There's no real strategy around it, and you can see that Ten Hag now coming in is obviously wasted no time. He wants to put his own stamp on things. He's clearly going to want to bring in his own players, and he wants to get rid of some of that debt that has lingered from the previous campaign. So it's something that 100% should have been done 12 months ago. It's absolutely no surprise to see both players exit Old Trafford now, and I would say for the majority of Manchester United fans, they'll probably be quite satisfied with that news.
The only financial gain for Paul from Paul Pogba in Manchester was for the hairdressers. He definitely spent a good few quid on hair dye. They were the only winners out of that. And I felt a bit sorry for Jesse Lingard. He was flying at West Ham. I'd say he might like to have stayed there and probably would have been better for his career, Paul.
Yeah, he probably would have been. And it's hard to put your finger on why it didn't work out for Lingard when he returned back to Manchester United. He probably sued maybe the style at West Ham, and maybe more about West Ham's play was about Lingard, and it went through him, and maybe that brought out more of the positive elements of his own game. And it just hasn't been the right fit at Manchester United, and I certainly think that it's right for him to move on, to progress his own career. If you think about the World Cup that's coming up, if Jesse Lingard had a good season last year, there's every chance he would have been in contention for a spot there. But he's not the only one, Ruby. Like, I'd be of the opinion, I think Rashford should be shown the door as well. You think about some of the contracts they've handed out as well with Matic and Mata, Eric Bailly. Like, just some of the decisions with the players that they've brought in, the players that they've kept, would linger major question marks in my head about how the club is run. Everybody says this, but it's only when you look at the players and the performances that they've produced over the last number of weeks and months and years that you see why these players are leaving the club. For Lingard, yes, it's difficult. He's come through the academy. He's obviously a Manchester United boy, childhood fan, but he should have gone 12 months ago. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
The Wednesday of a bank holiday week always seems to linger. You're getting closer to the weekend, but it's still far enough away. And the longer we talk about Manchester United, the longer it's lingering in my mind anyway.
Do you know, I'm loving the sarky comments here, and also with the haircut. And David Snaid, friend of the show, tweeted earlier, Manchester United have finally found Paul Pogba's best position. All I'm saying, lads, you know, one of the world's best midfielders on his day.
What day was that exactly? Wait.
But he can be, and I think that's what frustrates people, is that he just doesn't seem to get the performances, or he doesn't want to get the performances out of him.
Ruby, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, greatness is longevity. Like, greatness is consistency. That is what greatness is, and I don't think either of those can be applied to Paul Pogba.
Well, when he re-signs for Manchester United, twice World Cup winner in 2038 now or something. Yeah.
He's a perfect example of somebody being completely overpaid, isn't he?
He has the what I call the David Healy factor. Plays better for his country than he does club.
He probably needs an N'Golo Kante type figure in beside him. Probably suits a European style of football.
That's a big help, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Listen, this debate could go on long into the night. Paul, you're going to be sticking around for the hour, because we are going to get into our football chat a little bit later on, just to give people an update on UEFA Nations League. Poland are currently playing Wales. It is nil all just into the second half there. I believe Danny Ward pulled off a worldie of a save against Robert Lewandowski to deny him. So it is nil all in Poland. Wales will be chatting Ukraine, Scotland.
Before you go, Shane.
Yes.
Lewandowski, even, sorry, Paul, is wanting out of Bayern Munich. Would he fit at Manchester United if you're getting rid of Rashford?
Oh, I'll bring you back to the same debate that they had last year about Ronaldo coming into the building and potentially being maybe at the tail end of his career, and where does that kind of lend itself if you're trying to build a 4 or 5 year project? On
no,
paper and statistics wise, statistics wise, you'd have to say yes. And I mean, he actually came out recently and he was speaking about kind of goals wise and performance wise, he feels as sharp as ever. Of course, he's going to say that, but the statistics back it up. I think he broke Gerrit Muller's record. Was it this year or last season?
Yeah.
And he's consistently scored goals wherever he's gone. But I mean, he's made no qualms about it. Like, he wants to go to Spain, and he's probably looking at the weather forecast in Barcelona and Madrid, and then putting Manchester beside it, maybe sitting down with his wife and saying, yeah, there's no chance of going there.
Beautiful city that is Manchester. A lot of time for Manchester. Well, on paper, Paul Pogba would do a job, so however, if you get Lewandowski or whoever, Eric.
But you say that about Manchester. So how many players are going to look at Newcastle with all the money and have the very same thought?
Yeah, I don't think the creme de la creme around Europe are going to want to go to Newcastle. I think, you know, when you see any of the top players on the market, even, you know, if you want to go to the extremes, the likes of an Mbappe or a Salah, they're never going to be linked to Newcastle at this moment in time. At least that's the way I would see it, until they become a real force with regards to Champions League football. They're probably better off starting maybe a rung or two down and looking at the likes of Calvin Phillips and a Declan Rice and trying to add them to their squad before maybe they attack some of the bigger names. But I have no doubt about it that, you know, the bigger players in Europe take all these factors into consideration when they're making a move. And
the fine dining of Newcastle as opposed to the nightlife.
Well, I'd say more the shopping for their wives.
Yeah, look at Frankie de Jong. Is he going to trade in Barcelona for Manchester after particularly seeing what's happened with Donny van de Beek?
Well, it's a new manager now. So particularly seeing what happened with Donny van de Beek, but it's Erik ten Hag and it's playing under a new philosophy, yeah. New way of thinking.
Anyway, Wales have scored. Johnny Williams scored 1-0 to Wales.
That's exactly why we have Paul Corrie in, keeping us up to date with all things soccer.
Cilic has beaten Rublev and Roland Garros.
Oh, there you go, keeping us up to date with tennis, Ruby. Well, that brings us on perfectly to our tennis discussion in the company of Conor Nyland, who of course was on with yourself, Ruby, last night, and indeed Gary Cahill now joins us, former Irish Davis Cup and Fed Cup captain who coaches on the WTA and ATP Tour. And I suppose, gentlemen, only one place to start. Rafael Nadal demonstrated once again why he's the greatest player in French Open history by beating long-term rival Novak Djokovic in a late-night thriller to reach the men's singles semi-finals. Before we get the thoughts of Conor and Gary, let's hear from the man himself, Rafa Nadal.
Very, very tough match. No, Novak is one of the best players of the history, without a doubt. So always play against him is an amazing challenge. No, all the history that we have together today was another one. And to win against Novak, there is only one way, is to play at your best since the first point till the last. No, and today it has been one of these magic nights for me, unexpected level, but I am super happy. So thank you very much. Without a doubt, there is no one other place like this one for me. No, it's the most important court of my tennis career, the most special one. And as I said before in French, I don't know if I was able to speak the proper way, but for me, feel the love of everyone here in Paris, in the most important place of my career. It means everything to me.
So, Conor Nyland, 24 hours ago, you weren't overly optimistic for Rafa Nadal. Did Novak Djokovic underperform, or did Rafa just do what Rafa always does?
Yeah, I overthought that prediction, Ruby, last night.
We all do that at times.
Yeah, look, I can't believe I went against Nadal at the French. In hindsight, I was sitting there a set and 3-love to Nadal, thinking, I just didn't think he had it in him to be just that sharp looking. He just hasn't looked, as I was talking about last night, that lively, that aggressive for the last few weeks. But he just, you know, the champion in him came out, and he just, I think he shocked Djokovic the first 45 minutes or so with the level. And then Djokovic, in fairness, nearly reeled him back in. Was obviously had two set points to bring it to a fifth in the fourth set. We're talking late into the night at this stage. I don't know how many people were still up in Ireland watching it, but it was phenomenal tennis. It was a shame it went on sort of so late. There's a few conversations happening at Roland Garros, I think, today about the nighttime schedule and how it needs to be tweaked, because it is getting on a little bit too late in the evening, some of these finishes. But it was phenomenal entertainment, and it's different gravy when those two play each other.
Gary, Conor explained to us in great detail last night about Rafa not being as sharp as he was, his preparation, etc., and how it had gone so well for Novak. But was that five-setter in the previous round a help to Rafa Nadal going into last night's game?
I don't know. I mean, Conor, I have to admit, I was like you. I didn't think that that Rafa actually had it in him to win that match either. And I see where Rafa, between the two matches now, has played 8.5 hours of tennis, which is huge. But I think it was a bit more that Novak hadn't played enough tennis, more so than Rafa had played too much tennis. But that's actually the first five-set match that Djokovic has played since last year's US Open. And I think that kind of came against him a bit as the match went on. Like, in normal situations, you never expect Djokovic to lose a set, you know, from that score and having set points at 5-3. You'd never expect it. He just probably wasn't as match tight as he needs to be.
Yeah, I think you're right, Gary. I think he's been playing great tennis in the best of three set format in the run up to this, but I think Nadal on Chatrier, kind of the world watching, and what Nadal was throwing at him, he just hadn't faced. And I think, yeah, if it had a run at Australia, he would have been a little bit more ready for it. He just looked a little bit shell shocked, like I think we all did, in fairness, from what Nadal was doing the first half an hour, 45 minutes, and then Nadal kind of rode that momentum then for the rest of the match and didn't fall over the line. But you know, I would have probably backed Djokovic if he'd gone to five, but Nadal just he got it done.
Connor,
I think it didn't help Novak as well that he had this beast on the other side of the court, but then it sounded like he was fighting the crowd as well. You know, that definitely 99% of people were shouting for Rafa. And I think at some point, if you're not really match fit and you haven't played enough, that has to wear you down a bit as well, even if you're Novak Djokovic.
So, Connor, if match fitness got the better of Novak, how concerning is Rafa's injury long-term, do you think? And even short-term, because now he'll face third seed Alexander Zverev on Friday. Zverev, of course, beat young teenage sensation Carlos Alcaraz. Can Zverev trouble Nadal, or will the injury trouble Nadal? Or do you think he will be able to get through it? You mentioned the crowd behind him as well, and all the positive kind of feeling around him now pushing forward.
I'm not betting against Nadal, lads.
Not again, anyway, says you.
He had an extra day as well, so he's got 2 days off. And look, Zverev is playing well. Yes, he can trouble him. And I think Zverev, I think maybe we're all a little bit surprised Zverev's kind of come out of that half and found himself in the semi-finals. Alcaraz is just a couple of years off, I think, you know, being able to win that match against him yesterday in the quarterfinals, but he's been incredible to watch the last week or so. But look, I think Nadal is, you know, to get over that huge match in the quarterfinal, I just think he's going to be, I think he's just going to be so up for this semi-final, and can he sneak a 14th Roland Garros? And then he'll then be sitting at 22 slams. There'll be a bit of daylight between him and Djokovic and Federer at 20. So Lucas, he'll be tough to beat.
Who am I to question the tennis experts? But lads, Nadal leads 20-8 in head-to-head on clay. It's 110 wins and 113 matches in Roland Garros now for Rafa Nadal. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked earlier at the start of the show about the stats and figures and everything else, but I suppose you can't always rely on them. Looking at the other side of the draw, I know you're not going to back against Nadal, or Connor at least isn't, but Gary, I suppose, can anyone put it up to him if he gets over Alexander Zverev, looking at the competitors are still in it? Obviously, it's, with respect, probably the weaker side.
I don't know. I mean, if you're looking at that draw, you definitely want it to be on the bottom half of the draw, you know, with Ruud and, you know, possibly Cilic. I don't know. I think that's probably going to be the semi-final. It would be difficult to see either Ruud or Cilic beating Nadal. I can't really see it. Cilic, of course, is dangerous, but the type of game that Rafa plays on play, I really think that Nadal and Zverev is more or less the final. Now, don't quote me on that if it goes the other way, but that's the way I see it. And you know, a lot of people would have said it possibly yesterday was the real final as well. But no, I think the bottom half in general is weaker.
Connor, there is more than the men's singles competition at Roland Garros, and obviously the women's one is down to the semi-finals, but does that look like a complete one-horse race? Iga Swiatek is just unstoppable?
Yeah, she's. I think she's now at 33 matches in a row. You know, stretching back to the start of the year. So I know Venus Williams has the record of 35 wins in a row, so she is, breaking new ground, really. You know, if she can win this tournament, she's up at equaling that, the kind of the best run we've ever seen. She looked incredible a couple of years ago at Roland Garros. It seems like it's her, it's where she plays her best tennis. It's Kasatkina tomorrow in the first semi-final. So yeah, I can't really see past Swiatek. If she turned 21, I think today, she potentially could start to accumulate an awful lot of slams if she can maintain that consistency that's been so difficult. And obviously Barty retired, who's probably the best player in the world over the last 18 months, she's now out of the equation. So yeah, I'm definitely gonna go with Swiatek on this for the next couple of days.
Well, it will be interesting to see how the French Open pans out. Connor and Gary, thank you both very much for taking the call. Iga Swiatek, of course, plays Kasatkina, as mentioned there, and it's Coco Gauff against Italy's Trevisan in the other semi-final. And all eyes, of course, on Rafa Nadal. Before we turn our attention to soccer after the break, Paul, I suppose I have to welcome you back into the conversation. You were keeping a keen eye on the tennis as well. How much did you enjoy things?
Yeah, listen, it's actually a sport I love watching. I probably... lends itself to a footballer's career when you have plenty of time during the week. You can watch it, but it was an incredible game, incredible athletes, and to see them still continually doing it at that level for the period of time that they've done is just remarkable. There was a great piece of commentary last night. The game started in May and finished in June, so it was certainly a late one, but I managed to stay up for it. Nadal's an animal on clay. I am no expert, but it's impossible to see beyond him, and I just think it's remarkable. You know, you look at Lionel Messi and Ronaldo, and we talk about these two athletes as being, you know, so pivotal and prominent in football, but you only have to look at tennis and you've got Djokovic, Nadal, yeah, and Federer, and just three greats, and I'm sure we'll see Nadal go on and win the competition.
Yeah, we're blessed to have so much talent that we are able to view. We're going to be turning our attention to soccer in a few moments' time, so stick with us. I caught up with the BBC's Roddy Forsyth a little bit earlier before we came on air. We'll chat to Roddy on Scotland-Ukraine, and myself, Ruby and Paul, will dissect all of today's other sports news and Italy Argentina in the finalissimo. So do stay with us here on 2FM.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on.
Football.
Now, I'm delighted to say Roddy Forsyth joins us, our Scottish football expert, as we turn our attention to Scotland versus Ukraine. And Roddy, all eyes on Glasgow for a host of reasons. It is not just about the football this evening. And actually, I'd like to begin our conversation by reading an extract, just a paragraph from Tom English on the BBC website, who says, Hampden, in its different guises, has been so many storied occasions, from the largest crowds in the world in the 1930s to the greatest game in the world at the start of the 1960s, when Di Stefano, Puskas and their fellow Real Madrid marauders turned the grey old place technicolor with their genius. Kenny Dalglish nutmegging Ray Clemens, Zinedine Zidane's volley against Leverkusen, Lee Griffiths' free kicks against England, David Gray's header that brought an end to Hibs' 114-year wait to win the Scottish Cup, every drama under the sun, every emotion imaginable, or so we taught. I've always been told to keep politics and sport separate, but in this case, Roddy, it's going to be very much to the fore.
It's going to be a supercharged occasion emotionally. We saw Ukrainian players in tears at their press conference. We know that they feel this very strongly. Steve Clark, the Scotland boss, I was talking to him yesterday, said we empathise with them. We feel for them. We cannot imagine, although we can try to, what they've been through. He said, but the best respect we can give them is to play them in a proper game of football as they will want to play. He said that will partly take the minds of some Ukrainian people off what they're going through, and perhaps it will leave a legacy for one or other of the teams. And I must say that I think that he pitched that absolutely correctly. There are 3,500 Ukrainian fans who will be present at Hampden this evening. Amongst them will be a group of orphans, war orphans, invited by the SFA to be a part of that group. On every seat there's going to be a printed sheet with the words to the Ukrainian national anthem, so that the Tartan Army can join in and sing and effectively embrace them into Hampden Park before the action starts.
In terms of how ready these players are, now you've been dealing with the Scottish manager, Steve Clark, and chatting to Scottish players. How difficult do you feel it will be from the Scottish point of view, to park the emotion of the occasion and concentrate on the job at hand? Because I think it was Andy Robertson who was saying pretty much the whole world will be rooting for Ukraine, but we do have a job here and looking to qualify for a World Cup.
Well, I did say to Steve Clark, it's perhaps fortunate for Scotland that Eurovision Song Contest rules don't apply, because of course we saw our winner from the UK soar away in the jury vote and then be eclipsed by the international phone vote. And I don't doubt for a moment that if there were to be a global phone vote that could influence the outcome of this match, it would sweep Ukraine forward to the playoff final against Wales, and no doubt through that as well. Interestingly enough, there are 10 overseas-based players in the Ukraine squad, so although they haven't played a competitive match since last autumn, there are those ones that have been playing, the likes of Zinchenko for Manchester City, Mikolenko for Everton, West Ham's Yarmolenko, Yaramchuk, who plays for Benfica. They are notable players in this squad. The rest, of course, we know they've been playing friendly matches. They've got a training camp in Slovenia. They've played friendly matches at club against clubs in Italy, Croatia and Germany. I don't doubt there's any question about them having bonded. But they'll also be up against a Scotland squad who have bonded under Steve Clark. They're undefeated in their last 8 games. And although Ukraine and Wales are both higher than the Scots, Nevertheless, in their qualifying group, Scotland beat Denmark, who are currently in 11th place. So there's a shape and a spirit to the Scottish team that will, I think, make this an intriguing contest. I shouldn't be at all surprised if it were to go to extra time and penalties, just to stretch the nerves to the maximum on both sides.
Is this Scotland's best chance of qualifying for a World Cup in 24 years, given the players they have and the route laid out now through these playoffs?
Well, I've seen them come very close at times, but this squad has bonded very well. They've gelled, I have to say. They've got a shape that means that even though there are going to be injuries like Kieran Tierney, who's not going to be able to play tonight, and he's an anchor on the left side of a 3-man defence as a rule behind Andy Robertson. Nevertheless, when we were speaking to Steve Clark yesterday, and it was suggested he might want to change the shape of the side, go to a 4 at the back, and he might do that. But he was saying to us he doesn't feel any compulsion to do so, because the team now understands what's wanted from him, from the management team, from their colleagues in the squad and in the playing team. He believes they've now found a rhythm and a character to such an extent that he doesn't have to change the shape, that he can just put player in for player on a one-for-one basis. And that's an immense improvement. 3 years ago, Scotland were in the very early stages of playing under Steve Clark, had back-to-back 4-0 defeats or 4-goal defeats by Russia, ironically enough, and Belgium, which was a masterclass at Hampden Park and led people to wonder whether or not Steve Clark was the man to do it. But he's a devoted soul, he's a dedicated type, he works in a low-key manner, and he has forged a team here whom I think we can say will at least be competitive at almost any level in the world.
Well, of course, there will be Irish eyes on this one, because they are in Ireland's Nations League group. I know you've been dealing with the Scottish side of things and with Steve Clark in particular, but I was drawn to a quote from the Ukrainian head coach, Alexander Petrikov, and he said, "There will be an incredible atmosphere at Hampden, but after rockets and bombs, we are not afraid of anything." I mean, that's... It took me back, to be fair. I was very taken back by even just reading that comment and seeing those words, because that is what Ukraine have had to dealt with, and that is what the emotion that they're bringing here. How do you feel, or what do you expect to see from the Ukrainian players and the Ukrainian side of things this evening?
I would hope that it will be a measured performance. I'm sure they will be emotional before the game. But as we've seen at all levels of sport, if emotion can inspire you, but it can overburden you also. So somehow they have to find a middle ground there, a concentration principally on the football, even though their blood will be fired up. And aside from the obvious that you mentioned there, the bombs, the rockets, when you consider that there are 4 million Ukrainians exiled, I think, in Poland, many more in Romania, Hungary, Germany, Moldova, Slovakia, I think the total is around the 7 million mark. There cannot be anybody in Ukraine, you fancy, who has not been affected by this and is being affected on an ongoing basis. And I imagine that given the fact that there will be a substantial, it won't be a giant Ukrainian presence in the ground, but I'm sure they'll make themselves heard and they'll make themselves seen. And I imagine that will fire up this Ukrainian side if it needs any firing up.
Absolutely. Well, it should be very interesting to see how this one unfurls. Kickoff at Hampden Park for Scotland versus Ukraine is at 7:45 this evening. Roddy Forsyth, thank you very much for taking the call.
A pleasure, Shane.
Game on.
Football.
Paul, I think it's fair to say that Shane and Roddy covered all the emotional and political angle of this match tonight between the Ukraine and Scotland. But when you look at the Ukraine as a soccer nation, and this team in particular, they were unbeaten in qualifying. They finished runners-up to France in their group. Like, on form, they probably can beat Scotland.
Yeah, they could do. I think it's going to be a really close game. I always think that home vantage is vitally important in situations like that, like this, and that certainly plays against Ukraine having to go to Scotland. But you're right, Ruby. Particularly under Shevchenko when he was in charge, they were an impressive outfit. They were probably part of that, let's say, second tier of nation in behind the likes of your Italy's, France, England's, Germany's, and they were pushing on that front. They're probably a little bit behind from where they are today. Maybe some of the players have kind of pushed on a bit, and particularly with what's gone on in the country, their club teams have obviously suffered on a European front, which is maybe going to impact that level of performance. But it's certainly a stiff fixture for Scotland tonight. Just looking at it and seeing the form that Scotland have had in the last number of months, particularly that little push that they had in their qualifying campaign to get second place, I'd probably fancy them tonight. But you're absolutely right. Like, when you look at the likes of Yarmolenko, Mikhailenko, Zinchenko, the players that we're familiar with have done really well in the Premier League over the last 12 months. And if they can come to the fore, it's going to be a stiff challenge, but probably one where just the home form, the trajectory of Scottish football over the last 12 to 18 months, I think this is one that Scotland will win.
I was going to talk over you there.
I fully get that, but when you looked at the Ukraine, Paul, like, their away form and qualifying was much better than their home form. I'm not really sure why that was, but they obviously can travel. They took 8 points from a possible 12 and drew with the French in Paris. Like, they're nearly better outside of Kiev than they are in Kiev.
Yeah, and listen, everybody's going to be rallying behind them tonight. There's certainly going to be a huge level of support for Ukraine to go through tonight. And yeah, listen, it could be those results, particularly the one that you mentioned against France and taking points against an incredibly impressive French team, will certainly be one that they could build confidence on. But if you just take it back to the European Championships when they played England, I thought in that game when it really mattered, they just looked as if they were lacking in certain departments. England, yes, of course, are an impressive nation, but you probably saw some of the gaps in their capabilities that they have, and that would probably restrict them in certain areas, particularly when they get on in competitions. But if you're talking about the game tonight, yes, of course. If they produce a performance tonight, they've been in camp for a long period of time in the run-up to this game that will hopefully be of benefit to them. But there's something about Scottish football, I think it's one that we can look at and try to emulate. I think the way that they've produced players over the last number of years, you look at kind of the players they have in their squad, the likes of McTominay, Billy Gilmore, Linda Dykes, Che Adams, and under these players are playing at the top end of the championship or playing a lot of their football in the Premier League. If we could kind of emulate something along those lines, it's probably a case study that we look at and try to emulate. But I think in that sense, with the players that Scotland have, with the form that they have combined with that, I just see them going through tonight. But yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Ruby. We might be here in 2 hours' time and 3-0 Ukraine win.
Well, Ruby's always put Conor Nyland again a while there for his wrong predictions yesterday. So
I didn't. Everyone can choose wrong in choosing two players. To me, you look at form. Rafa was the form on the clay. And I think when you're looked, maybe I look at it too practically, but when you're looking at form, I mean, Scotland scraped past the Faroe Islands, scraped past Moldova, was it? 1-0 and 1-0. They just don't inspire me.
But in lack of goal scoring, I mean, I think Shea Adams and Lyndon Dykes haven't scored in 13. John McGinn has found the net just once in 26 games. I know their defenders chip in with a few goals, so it will be interesting. And as I mentioned with Roddy Forsyth a little earlier on, is it's going to be a hugely emotional occasion as well. 3,000 Ukrainian fans in Hampden Park, so it will be very interesting to see how that one goes. Just keeping you up to date with Poland-Wales, it is 1-1 now. Kaminski scored a 72nd equaliser. There are just over 10 minutes left in that one.
I mean this in the best possible way now. Could you imagine sitting down in the seat tonight in Hampden Park and picking up the Ukrainian national anthem and being expected to sing it?
Yeah, it's... Having said that, I think they've spelt it phonetically.
I hope to have. I wish I could get some of that phonetical spelling for names of tennis players, even to do me.
Well, it will be interesting to see how that one goes. So, Poland, Wales, Ukraine, Scotland. Paul, I do want to pick your brains on Finalissima, the first one since 1992. Argentina versus Italy. Great to see these old European competitions back. I've been one for calling for the return of the European Cup Winners' Cup, calling for a return of the Fairs Cup. And now we have this one back that sees the winner of Europe go head-to-head with the winner of South America, Italy, Argentina, and hopefully a host of talent on show.
Yeah, hopefully. It's obviously probably a fixture that Italy would be looking forward to, but obviously with the disappointment that they had with their qualifying campaign, it's maybe one where they're approaching in a bit of a different mindset. But yeah, let's hope tonight that we're kind of seeing a bit of a free-flowing football. There's no reason why this should be played with any sort of tactical nous around us. You'd love to see the Italians and the Argentinians kind of just playing out from the back and getting some of their star players on show. So it's certainly a spectacle. It should be a good watch. It'd be interesting to see how it goes, particularly with what's happened to Italy, the way they threw away their qualifying campaign for the World Cup was terribly disappointing. The tournaments without Italy don't seem to be as enjoyable. So
and their shocker of a new jersey.
I haven't seen it.
Oh,
is it Puma as bad as Cameroon's going back to years?
Puma have done them right in. It's like a knockoff Blackford shirt or something.
Because that's really going to matter.
Sorry, Ruby, this is why you tune into Game On. We get to the heart of the nation's issues at sport.
I mean, I can see them standing in the dressing room tonight thinking there's no way you can expect me to play well wearing that.
I think on
that note, Shane Dawson, we should take a break. Nadine Doherty is up next.
RTE 2FM. Game On 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game On 2FM.
Well, you're very welcome back to Game On with myself, Shane Dawson, and Ruby Walsh as we turn our attention to ladies Gaelic football in the company of Nadine Doherty. But before we do, just to update you on the tennis, it is two sets apiece between Rublev and Cilic. Rublev took the first set 7-5, Cilic hit back 6-3. He went on to win the third set 6-4 before losing the fourth set 6-3. So hopefully a bit of entertainment in that one. And it is 2-1 to Poland against Wales, a goal in the 85th minute there for Poland. And finally, before I introduce Nadine, Ruby, just to cover myself, Puma make lovely kits, namely the Uruguay kit and the Ghana kit. So
I'd say now that's the least of your worries, Shane Dawson, right now, because you have just introduced ladies football. And Marie Crowe, get your hands on you are for it. It's women's.
It is
God,
women's.
You have made a fatal error.
Well,
I am fearing for your safety.
Well, see, now, Ruby, the LGFA and the AFLW, that's what I'm going off here as Nadine throws me daggers.
No daggers.
I'm just marking your card. Marie Crowe gets her hands on you.
So, before we talk about women's Gaelic football, Nadine Doherty, I want to talk about AFLW, which is, of course, the Australian Football League for women's. So, they have confirmed that both Vicky Wall and Erica O'Shea have signed contracts with North Melbourne Kangaroos. Meads, Vicky Wall, the reigning footballer of the year, and Erica O'Shea of Cork, who was named on last year's All-Star team, were among the leading players in last year's championship. So, I mean, well, Vicky's 24 years of age. She rejected Hawthorne, who are a new addition to the AFLW, in favour of North Melbourne. So short term, it looks like she'll be sticking around for the All-Ireland run. But long term, how big of a blow is this to Meath football?
Yeah, I suppose it's the news we've been waiting for. You know, it was inevitable that Vicky was going to go at some point. Bad news for Meath, definitely, Shane. You know, for Meath, she's integral to their game plan. If you watch Meath, everything they do, the way they set up defensively, the way they move the ball in transition, it's all set up to get Vicky on the ball. And look, she's their superstar. She's their number one player. I think looking at her and Erica, I think they're two players who'll take really different paths down there. You know, Vicky will have an immediate impact. She has the potential not to be a huge force in the league. I think she has the potential to be one of the best players in the league. Like, she's just built for it. Her pace, her power, her work rate. And, you know, she's the kind of athlete who'll excel in any sport. she's irreplaceable for Meath, you know, as we've already said. And then it's interesting for her, you know, she's going to be allowed to finish the season with Meath, whereby Eric O'Shea, she's not around for the Cork campaign. I'd imagine that she has to go to Australia sooner because she would have a lot more physical work, strength and conditioning to do. And, you know, they've also described her as a player who, you know, she will have to wait a while before breaking the team because she's a player who can grow for them. So two different paths, I think, really exciting for both of them. And interestingly, Aileen Gilroy, who is originally from Mayo, was amazing for Hawthorn this year, and she's actually amazing for North Melbourne, excuse me, and she's going the other way to Hawthorn. So that's interesting. I would have liked to have seen her and Vicky maybe playing alongside each other. It would have been exciting. But look, really exciting for Vicky, just a massive loss for us here because we all love watching her play, especially at the weekend.
As I read the statement and read the ins and outs of it, it looks like Eric is going to the Tasmanian Kangaroos later this month. Is that like an underclub of North Melbourne or the Learner Trade?
I wouldn't be sure, Ruby, to be honest, because I'm not totally up to speed in the AFL, but I'd imagine so. Yeah, it's possibly like a player pathway, perhaps a lower league, and they'll build up her skills, build up her strength and conditioning, I suppose, with the view to maybe breaking her into the team. Maybe not this year, maybe in the future. I mean, she's only 19. Like, she's so really young. Really, so young. And I mean, it's such a different sport to the GAA. Like, some skills are transferable, but, you know, even looking at her stature, she's a slight enough girl. But she'll break in at some point, I'd say.
And we talk about, she's only 19. You're not moving from Mayo to Dublin or anything like that. You're going to a different country, you know, halfway around the world as well. So we can all remember when we were 19 about the challenges that we thought were big. I mean, this is going to be perhaps not a huge culture change, but it's going to be a big move for such a young person.
Yeah, it's a big move. You know, like when we were 19, like I moved from Donegal to Dublin, or, you know, I did spend a while in New York.
Was that a culture change?
No, not too much at times. I also spend time in New York, but, you know, Australia is so far away. You know, and in Ireland, you know, you might be moving to a different city, but you still have a support network, you still have your family. So, yeah, I'd say it'll be a big enough challenge for Erica. But look, she wouldn't be going if she didn't think she was able for it, so we'd wish her the best of luck.
At the end of the day, it's only a day away, Australia, but it is a massive opportunity. I mean, can you honestly look at either and think they shouldn't do it? I mean, to me, I look at it and think, wow, it's an opportunity. They're young to go and play professional sport. Go and do it.
Yeah, 100%. You know, you also look at it, just depends, I suppose, how for me, I suppose, Ruby, bring it back to myself, I would look at the sport that I prefer to play. I used to play soccer and Gaelic, and I love both of them, and I chose Gaelic as my sport because I preferred to actually kick a Gaelic football and play the game. But, you know, as you said, like, it's a professional opportunity, it's massive, and it's only a day away. And look, for those girls, why not give it a go? You know, Ireland's always going to be here. Meath and Cork will be here, maybe not winning, but they'll be here.
It's all cyclical. They will come back and obviously be challenging, and we look forward to a really competitive championship this summer. And I do want to talk about that, but just, I suppose, my final question to wrap up the AFLW kind of chat, and reading comment from Reese Harwood, who's their talent and performance manager, just on Erica specifically, and he said, "We've been really impressed with the traits and impact Erica has shown with Cork. Her speed, agility and ability to cover the ground stand out, as well as her capacity to find a balance between defending and attacking in Gaelic, and we think her attributes will give her scope to play through a variety of positions for us." So obviously versatility is a big sell there. If Reese Harwood there, the talent and performance manager, is chatting to Eric, is this something that we will see? Listen, there's a host of Dublin players gone down there. You mentioned Aileen Gilroy, Clara Fitzpatrick's returning to St Kilda's. Is there a worry or a concern that this might become a lot more frequent, and then so the game here diminishes? Because even you look at Women's National League, you mentioned you play soccer. The FAI don't allow that league to be professional, and so the best teams in Ireland, they're handpicked by Scottish clubs and English clubs. And listen, I know the Gaelic football is amateur and everything else, so there's the difference there. But in terms of diminishing the quality of the talent that we have,
I don't think it will diminish the quality of the talent. We lose top talent, absolutely, but the volume and the numbers of players who are coming through the ranks here, I think they'll replace them. We went through something similar a few years ago with the rugby. You know, a lot of girls went to rugby sevens, they went to the 15s, and, you know, the LGFA, it kept flowing. I do think the LGFA probably have to look at it maybe from a commercial point of view. You know, if you compare even both Instagrams, like, it's the draw, obviously, would be Australia. I know it's a professional setup. They have way more resources, they have way more finances. But, you know, I think it's something that the LGFA have probably looked at and they probably have a bit of a plan in place. But yeah, look, the numbers are growing year on year, Shane. I think it'll just continue to grow. We're a pool of players for the AFL and at the minute they can handpick who they want.
Yeah, I agree with you, Nadine. I think it'll encourage more ladies to play women's GAA because of the opportunities that could come from it. I think it's a great thing. But anyway, look, we have provincial finals at the weekend. Dublin, 9 in a row, defeating the All-Ireland champions Meath. They turned it around from Parnell Park 3 weeks ago. Meath were a point to winner that day, but they came out the wrong side of it on Sunday.
Oh yeah, you know, last week Marie and I were speaking about the rivalry between the teams and looking at that game in Parnell Park where Dublin had, you know, struggled pace-wise a little bit, and that perhaps Mick Bowen had tapered off training a few weeks ago, sacrificing that round-robin game to ensure they were at full tilt for the weekend, and it very much looked like that. It was a game Dublin, I felt, completely dominated aside from the first 10 minutes of the second half. You know, they'd huge intent and Meath had no answer, and Dublin looked completely at home in Croke Park, and I think Meath will be really rattled after that, to be honest. Dublin should have won by double scores, I felt, and the Meath confident levels, you know, that have been very, very high of taking a bit of a bashing. You know, Dublin, as I said, they could have won by more. They had over 10 unforced errors in attack during the game, so they look at that and be disappointed. But the main factors behind their win was their tackling was absolutely excellent. You know, it was something that Mick Bowen had spoken about during the week. It was tactical at times. You know, they successfully stopped Meath in that middle third whereby Meath loved to bring that ball forward consistently all the time. But, you know, stat-wise, Dublin conceded almost three times as many fouls as Meath throughout the game. So, you know, that's something to look at. Dublin's width and attack was fantastic. Definitely something Mick Bowen had looked at. You know, they moved that defence that consists of 15 players, to be honest, most of the time. And they moved it over and back and created space and key players. Cole Owens, Lindsay Davey, Jennifer Dunn, Kate McDade, Sinead Goldrick, Leah Cafferty, the old heads, the experienced players, and, you know, Dublin really, really looked good. I haven't seen them look that good in probably a year, so they'll be really, really happy.
You just see when you look at the stats, Nadine, I mean, it took me 29 minutes to even score.
Yeah.
Is that a reflection on how good Dublin were, or how maybe off the pace Meath were?
No, to be honest, Ruby, I felt watching it, and people might disagree, I felt the credit would have to go to Dublin, to be honest. Meath really struggled. As I said, they struggled to break that line around the middle. Dublin were very physically, their tackling was excellent, I felt. And, you know, but, you know, you look at Meath, and this is why they're All-Ireland champions. They didn't have a sniff of the ball for 29 minutes, and then that point they scored could have been a goal, to be honest. It just showed how dangerous they are on every attack, and that was something that Mick Bowen had pointed out before the game. And then they followed that up with a lucky goal after half time and a point, and the next thing you know, they're right back in a game that they should have been out of sight. So Meath are going nowhere. A game that they really should have lost by a lot more. They hung on and were still in it with a couple of minutes to go. There were a few controversial calls. The Vicky
Wall. Give us
Wall.
Your call. Go on. Controversial. Yeah,
there are
the
two
fence,
really,
Come on.
Two that I feel Meath will be aggrieved by. The penalty. They were annoyed and they got a sim bin for that, but the penalty was a penalty. You can't foot block, and Marie O'Shaughnessy was unlucky. Look, she got back, she got her body behind the ball, but she did use her foot. And then Vicky Wall's yellow. I was getting loads of text messages and there were loads of tweets flying around. Again, it's my opinion, but I felt it was a yellow, and there were a few factors behind it, I thought. A few minutes before her own yellow card, Niamh O'Sullivan was fouled on the counter-attack, and Vicky Wall absolutely tore into Yvonne, the lineswoman. And so her card was marked with the lineswoman there, and maybe that influenced the ref's decision. There was another incident then between that and the yellow card where Vicky led with the shoulder, and she was very lucky to not catch Nicole Owens. And then the incident itself, look, you could argue that Vicky was blocked. She probably was blocked, but it was the Dublin player who fell to the ground, and Vicky got up and aggressively screamed in her face and then swung and missed at another player, and it was the lineswoman, her old pal, who was the one who brought it to the referee's attention. So I don't think Vicky or Meath could have any complaints about that, but I'm sure plenty of people will disagree with me. Did it have an effect in the game? No, I don't think so. I think Dublin were home and dry at that stage, but a talking point nonetheless.
Most certainly is, and it was a tight affair in Munster with Cork defeating Kerry. Unfortunately, Nadine, time is against us. You'll be back in chatting on the All-Ireland series, which starts on June 11th in, so what's that, 10 days time? So yeah, lots to look forward to in women's Gaelic football. So Nadine Doherty, thank you very much for popping into the studio. Paul Corrie is still with us. Paul, thank you very much. It has finished 2-1 to Poland against Wales. You were keeping your eye on that one for us, and I've just done your job for you, so apologies. But Paul Corrie, Nadine Doherty, thank you very much. Ruby, pleasure as always. Game on. We'll be back tomorrow evening from 6 p.m. But from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now. But do stay tuned to 2FM because Tara Kumar is up next with all the latest Irish music.
RTE 2FM.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.